details of the specific provision in the actual legislation. Separately, before I go into how we arrived at this legislation, it's important to paint a little bit of a picture of what the environment within which looks like. The multidisciplinary nature of our sector lends itself to being subjected to different legislation and different policies that may not necessarily, in the main, be within the mandate of the department. So there is a greater reliance on method of coordination in particular. And this then says, who exerts the authority? And that is why, Chairperson and honorable members, you will find that in some of the provisions we will be talking to, they can attempt to then deal with aspects which would squarely fall within the mandate of the department. But there would be other things that would be governed by other pieces of legislation, which we take very serious cognizance of, and we also make sure that in whatever other practices that we implement, those things are taken into account. For example, if we are looking at the fact that businesses should be registered to trade in the country, certain environments would look at what are the authorities in the country that actually deal with that kind of registration. We would realize that the first one would be our CTIC, which basically is within the Department of Trade and Industries, and that would then register the intellectual property rights, it would register the actual formation, whatever type of entity one wants to use to be able to facilitate trade. But again, there will be requirements within local government that this particular individual who wants to trade would have to actually have certain requirements fulfilled within that particular environment. So as we look at those, we ask fundamental questions as to whether that particular environment is sufficient or is not sufficient. And if it is sufficient, we then realize that there's no need for us to go further beyond what is actually provided for, rather we must have coordinating mechanisms with those authorities that are already in there. And it is the same with all other aspects, whether it is transportation, where you will find that there are operators, coach operators in particular, what they operate is a vital. And the vital must be carrying tourists. So we go and then re-register these people and so on, the database that she exists and is within that particular domain of the Department of Transport. So these are the kind of trade-offs that we look at. And in the main, as we do that, we also ask ourselves, is it in the interest of the state in general to educate something? So those are some of the guiding principles that we had looked at. So we then end up with what are the areas that when we look at, we think these areas, if we are not there, there's definitely going to be a gray area. But of course, in all these aspects, we then are guided by what is the policy position from the executive at that particular point in time. So that then comes into what then comes into the actual law overall. What did we have? What we had on the chair session was we had a Tourism Act of 1996, which was free, democratic, and it also created our constitution, which came in 1996. So there was a need for us to reflect on that and be able to say, are we now aligned, given some of the provisions that are actually in the Constitution? And among which is that the constitution was quite clear about terrorism being a concurrent fashion across all the trade spheres. So that actually came at a time when these acts were already in place. And to be fair, I mean, the acts by and large were just provided for South African tourism. And in there, there were some area that still needed to be looked into within the domain of African tourism. At that time, we were not even talking about business events, as an example, which is something that actually came into the conversation. We then went through... Next slide. We went through a very elaborate process, which was quite conservative in terms of being able to define exactly what it is that needed some degree of attention at that time. But many of us remained commercial. So what we wanted to make sure that it is developed in the manner as described in the policy framework, which is our white paper. And that trace of that will be alluded to as we go through the actual details of the presentation in terms of what different events it will bring with the council. Some of the amendments of that particular act was 1993, but that followed were really just taken to tourist guide, which really was almost the only area that was given attention in terms of if they had the requirement for this instruction and how such processes would actually unfold. But we needed to actually go far much beyond what was said in that one of the things that we probably will deliberate a lot on is methods that may not necessarily fall within the ambit of what one could call methods of law. And how do we deal with those issues when we in practice? So that this will be issues, for instance, like coordination. This will be issues like what goes into certain strategic frameworks. This will be issues like how some of the incentives of the current mandate of government are actually executed, but are not necessarily methods of law. They are probably methods of strategy. Some of them may not even be methods of policy, but could actually come into specific problems for us to then be able to execute. So those issues that we go into more detailed discussions will be very important. So the whole equation for us was completed when we had the actual mandate, which somewhat comes very well contained in the broader policy framework within the white paper. And that then 2009, there was an indication that we needed to scale up whatever contribution we were making at tourism, which led to the split of the Department of Environmental Affairs and Tourism and standalone Department of Tourism. And that department then started the process of actually reviewing that particular environment, putting together policies, putting together strategies, part of which was the national strategy for sustainable development. I would like to speak a little bit about this because this is part of what is provided for, which is what my job is also going to talk to. But when we go into the details of the national strategy for sustainable development, that is the main driver that we use to do tourism development in the country. That is the main battle that we use to do promotion of tourism in the country. That is the main battle that we use to bring in strategies to facilitate transformation, to bring in strategies to facilitate geographic spread, to bring in strategies to facilitate dealing with issues of seasonality and so on and so forth. So some of those issues would be contained within the strategy. Because they cannot necessarily be regulated, if I was to put it that way. The framework itself wouldn't allow, for instance, if we were to give an example about the nature of jobs that we require in the sector, it would be a method that is guided solidly by the regime that is provided by the Department of Labor to say these are the basic conditions of employment. This is how the employment should take place. And we then get subject to that. Again, if we're talking about how are we going to actually facilitate transformation in the country, the DCI would have broad-based black economic empowerment goals. They would provide for us through our share council to also have similar provision, but that is tailor-made for the sector that we are in. Now, that does not become something that we could then make part of our law, but it becomes something that we must execute as a responsibility from the law that the DCI is putting in place. So these are methods that we are then able to bring into this statement that we call the National Tourism Sector Strategy to be able to actually deal with how do we roll out this aspect in practice, if I were to put it like that. Honorable Chairperson, just to highlight some of the issues that the current existing policy framework which is based on the tourism white paper on the development and promotion of tourism in Sumatra of 1996. It is a serious emphasis on transformation. It's a serious emphasis on matters of access. It's a serious emphasis on matters of inclusivity in terms of involvement, particularly when it comes to communities involved. It's an emphasis on matters of service delivery, as the context of which here is the extent to which our services meet the needs of the client side. And our services, I'm talking about services of the sector market. It was quite emphatic on response to tourism and also methods of coordination. Most of these issues, honorable members, you will probably have discussed a whole lot of these issues on the presentation that we made the last time when we were dealing with the strategy of the department. And part of it is because some of them are not necessarily matters of law. So talking about service excellence, we have a service excellence program that is running to speak. And that goes to towns and specific areas, does particular training, and also makes sure that the reward elements that is attached to it in terms of people that are doing good and so on. There's a transformation program in the department that's running with some sort of issues that I alluded to around the broad-based economic empowerment codes. Specific coordination arrangements, some of which are provided by law, but not necessarily by this particular piece of legislation. This will be your MINMEX and the technical committees of the DG and the HODs that deal with this specific issue, and some of the outreach that is done through the domestic tourism branch in terms of getting to some of those municipalities and so on. There's a responsible tourism program within the department that deals with a whole number of issues. Amongst which is universal accessibility. We were sharing about the tourism incentive program. We were very, very specific about some of the programs that we're actually doing there to be able to enhance the status of the destination from a green point of view. And a whole host of other things that we're doing in that particular program. So with those few resolutions, I would like to stop at this. And I would hand over to my talking to actually go into the gist of what is contained in this particular piece of legislation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Honourable members, I will immediately go to slide number 8 that I have into the process that the department undertook for the review of the 1993 just to mention that this process started very well in 2009, a very well-coordinated process, because we not only started consultation with provinces, with businesses, when we had a draft decision, we started consulting with them at a time when we were defining the scope of what needs to be reviewed coming from the 1993 legislation. So the scope was well agreed with provinces, was well agreed with inputs coming from the private sector. maybe as represented by the Tourism Business Council of South Africa. Around July 2011, when the draft was, draft legislation was in place, few years approved it was gathered for comments. Quite a number of good comments that came into our domain, which were well responded to, well interrogated by both the minister and NEC, together with the department, including the provincial department. So every aspect of what is contained in the legislation, NIMEC had the opportunity to have a look at it, think about it, and gain the approval there or not to take the comments, and also in responding to the critical comments that were raised. The draft bill was negotiated in NEDLAC over a period of 6 weeks. We got very good comments when we were negotiating at NEDLAC. Some aspects of this in a way alluded to when we go to the content, we were able to show how we had dealt with the comments coming from the private sector and also from labor. Cabinet approved the draft bill for introduction in Parliament in May 2012. The chief legal advisor certified the bill in November, and then the bill was introduced in December to Parliament. We will now go to Chapter 1 of the Act. This chapter defines certain words and expressions. As we formulate this legislation, we will have a chapter, particularly at the beginning, that will talk to the interpretation and order. There will be certain phrases that are defined in the Act. But most importantly, this chapter also tells us how policy rules are the laws that we get. We take into cognizance that tourism is a functional area of the current process. This act aims to provide for the development and promotion of the community of tourism for the basis of the public, its residents and visitors. Provide for the continued existence of the South African Tourism Board, but also provide for the establishment of the Tourism Regional Council, provide to regulate the tourist guiding profession, and to review certain laws and to provide for methods connected to the needs. Under Chapter 1, again, very critical, the CMO recognizes the following about tourism, that it has grown considerably. The white paper, the 1996 white paper still talks about the potential of tourism. But in the end, there is a clear recognition that tourism has grown considerably. But also that planning within tourism is inadequate, uncoordinated, inconsistent, and fragmented. This is part of what was recognized in the white paper, where the white paper says there was lack of knowledge and information. This is sort of a repeat of that planning is inadequate, and mainly because there's no information. Transformation is vital to ensure sustainable growth and development of the sector. This is what the framework says. It also recognizes that challenges are best addressed by the spheres of government and private sector working together to create a conducive environment for the growth of tourism. According to Chapter 1, the Office of the Act is to promote responsible tourism for the benefit of South Africa and for the employment of the citizens and foreign visitors, to provide for the effective domestic and international marketing of South Africa as a tourist destination, promote quality tourism projects and services, also to promote for growth, development of the tourism sector, and to enhance cooperation and coordination between all spheres of government in developing and managing tourism. Quite a big shift from what was contained in the 1993 legislation. Chapter 2, I normally call it the tools for planning, filling in the gaps that the white paper recognized, that says there's lack of information and knowledge within the sector. So with that, this act then provides for the powers of the minister to establish the National Tourism Sector Strategy to promote the object of the act. It sets also the processes, the consultative processes that the minister needs to follow before establishing the National Tourism Sector Strategy. The act says us what the strategy must contain. It says it must at least provide for strategies, objectives, indicators, targets, plans, guidelines, procedures, and institutional arrangements relating to the promotion, development, and transformation of tourism. This is where all of this will be provided in the National Tourism Sector Strategy. You will realize, members, that for now, we do have the National Tourism Sector Strategy, which came before the promulgation of the act. And also realizing that the department is starting with the process to review the NTSS. So at the time when we are finished with the review of the tourism strategy, it must provide for what the act says it must provide for. The act also provides for the powers of the minister to gather information relating to tourism and also to create a database of information on tourism businesses for the purpose of planning and contributing to the development and growth in the tourism sector. There are regulations that are contained in Section 61 that will be the operation, that will provide for the operational aspect of how the database must look like. Under Chapter 2 as well, provision is made for the minister to determine norms and standards and indicators to show compliance with those norms and standards. In particular, the act provides the powers of the minister to come up with norms and standards for practicing responsible tourism, for achieving service excellence in the tourism sector, and for promoting the objects of this act, and also, as I've mentioned, the provisioning of tourism information services to the public. Now this is where we are trying to close the gap as well. The office of the F are to promote the practicing of responsible tourism. How that is going to be done will be contained in the practicing responsible tourism. The YPs are recognized workers within the industry. How we are closing that gap, coming up with the standards for achieving success. You do know, members, you know, recall that these two practicing the responsible tourism norms and standards are in place. Service excellence is in place in the tourism sector. The act also says that the norms and standards and indicators must be determined after a consultative process with the members of the industry councils of provinces and other public participation. Initially, one of our drafts had given power to the MSC to come up with norms and standards for provinces. But in one of the main meetings, then he said, you know, the norms and standards are best suited if they are to be developed by the Minister of Tourism. Maybe the reason being that they would prefer that norms and standards become consistent with the needs within provinces. Tourism makes no boundaries. The effort empowers the minister to issue codes of good practice within the tourism sector to guide conduct relating to the tourism services, facilities, and products. Chapter 3 mainly deals with the South African Tourism Board. The South African Tourism Board was established in terms of the 1983 legislation. The act said to continue the existence of the board. The focus in the 2014 Act is to reaffirm the marketing mandate of SAT. The functions are stated in the Act as to market South Africa as a domestic and international tourist destination. But unlike what was in the 1993 legislation, when I'm providing also for the marketing of tourism programs and facilities internationally and domestically. South African Tourism Board is also given the power to develop and implement a marketing strategy for tourism. That strategy of the Act must promote the object of the Act and also the National Tourism Sector Strategy. So their strategy must draw from the object of the Act and also the NTSA. They have the responsibility to advise the minister on any measures relating to tourism marketing. And also, with the approval of the minister, the Board of Ethics to establish a national convention bureau to the South Africa as a business tourism definition by coordinating bidding for international conventions and liaising with other organs of state and social bodies to promote South Africa as a business tourism destination. We must report to the minister on the work performance of the National Conventions Bureau. The board must also perform any functions and hopes upon it in accordance with the policy direction, not in conflict with this Act by the minister. I must also mention that the FAA's FAT must be managed in compliance with the PSMA. There are other sections, members, that talk to the composition of the board. The board will consist of at least 9 and not more than 50 members appointed by the minister on the basis of knowledge, experience and qualification. There's a process set out in the end in terms of how minister will appoint members of the board. Nominations and particular aspects are contained there. The powers of the board relating to the opening of offices is provided in there. Borrowing of money, insurance, employee staff, and signing of agreements in there. There's also provisions that are normally necessary to define when the secretary body is established. There will be provisions in terms of how they hold their meeting. We qualify to be appointed as a member and when that person might partake of it. There's also sections of the Act that deals with matters relating to meetings, funding, financial accountability, and remuneration of members of the board and others. The Act also goes on to deal with the appointment of the Chief Executive Officer of the board. The Chief Executive Officer, the Act says, is responsible for the efficient management of the business and the affairs of the board. Provision is also made for the board to determine an employment and remuneration policy applicable to the members of the board and for the chief executive officer to appoint staff for the South African Tourism Board. Chapter 4 provides for a grading system. In terms of the 1993 legislation, that Act merely said that the minister on the recommendation of the board will come up with a grading and certification system within the tourism sector and in other sector. That is why you will find FAT running with the grading criteria. But we have moved away from the term grading criteria. We are now ushering in a grading system. The Act empowers the minister to develop a national grading system for tourism with a view to maintaining or enhancing the standards and quality of tourism services, facilities and programs. Again, trying to go with that gap where the white paper said the poor services in the sector. The grading system must promote the object of the Act, the National Tourism Sector Strategy and Excellence in the provision of tourism services, facilities and programs. It must make provision for schemes for which tourism businesses can obtain membership and for the use and display of the insignia that is being done. Such as star or number of stars indicating the grading awarded in terms of the scheme. Furthermore, this chapter on the grading system, when we look at section 29, you'll see there where the Act says the total benefiting concern is hereby established. The Act is established for the purposes of implementing and managing the national grading system for the minister with the permit. But it also says that the minister will have oversight of the council. And in the case of the board provided for in Chapter 3 of the Act, the board contains various sections usually associated with the establishment of the duty tax board. The Act is written in such a manner that the similar the provisions that are contained for in the chapter that deals with the board are in the chapter that establishes the council with the necessary changes that required by the content. Like we have, for example, the Act laying down a procedure for the appointment of the members of the board. But because it's a similar approach, which for it is the same process, it has been repeated in the necessary changes. So the Act will not go to a great extent mentioning all that has been mentioned in terms of the chapter containing the board, but making reference to that chapter, to that section that is contained in the necessary section of the board. For the grading council, the chapter provides for the appointment of a chief quality assurance officer who is responsible for supervising the processes of grading and for the strategic management of the grading system. The chief quality assurance officer must ensure conformity to standards and appoint staff to assist in performing those actions. Section 24 authorizes the minister to assign oversight of the council and the performance of any function of the council to the department, the board, or any other suitable body which is subject to the Finance Management Act. The last part of this sentence was, of this clause, section, was a matter of big debate when we were meddling. Private sector was saying we must make provision for any other body that can be created, maybe as an interim measure. But we also insisted that we will want that body to be accountable, and that is why the reference to the Public Finance Management Act. It is a body that will do grading, because grading is so important, it must be an accountable body, and accountability will be in accordance with the Public Finance Management Act. Another chapter that chapter 5 provides for tourism protection. There was no mention of tourism protection in the 1993 legislation. Now this chapter empowers the minister to designate an official of the department as a tourism complaints officer. The functions of the tourism complaints officer are to recommend to the minister the accreditation office team arrangement established by or for a particular tourism sector to resolve tourism complaints and to monitor the effectiveness of accredited schemes and also to receive complaints and to refer them to appropriate functionaries specified in Section 47. Among them will be the South African Police Services, where a complaint identifies a crime or an offense, the Equality Court, the complaint alleges discrimination, the National Consumer Commission, where they are properly based to deal with such a complaint, and also any other scheme within the tourism sector that has been established to resolve tourist complaints. This is part of the work that has been there in the department. Even before the promulgation of the 2014 Act, the department has always been receiving complaints and referring them to the National Consumer Commission. There's a lot of discussions going on with them in terms of ensuring that complaints do not decimate of the unit and the consensus of tourists. They are here tomorrow, to the time they are back, and it's back to their home. they leave and their complaints, they're not so confident that their complaints are being taken, they may not come next. We provided for this chapter mainly to ensure that the department ensures that the finality when a complaint is lodged, but also that we will be in a position to understand the nature of the complaints that are within the tourism sector, and also to come up with intervention when it's done. Under chapter 6, we find the tourism guide. The management of tourism guides has been a big part in terms of the 1993 legislation. Not much changes have been effected in the 2014 legislation. The Act says the minister must appoint the National Register of Tourist Guides. It gives the responsibilities of the National Register of Tourist Guides to answer. It should be responsible to maintain a central database of tourist guides, prepare code of conduct and ethics, hear and detain an appeal launched against the provincial register. And also the second element of what the National Register of Tourist Guides does is to liaise with the role players in the tourist sector with a view to facilitate growth in the sector and also improving and maintaining standards in the tourist guide sector. Provincial Register of Tourist Guides appointed by MSC, responsible for tourism in each province. The Act set out the functions of Provincial Register, which includes, among others, to register. If a person, any person who wants to register as a tourist guide, will direct their application to the provincial department. So the function is needed to register and maintain a register of tourist guides within the province. Provide national register of information, deal with complaints against tourist guides like the way institute disciplinary steps against a tourist guide where they think it's justified, exercise disciplinary powers, and they've got a responsibility to disseminate information about registered tourist guides. There's also a procedure set out in Section 50 for relating to the legislation of tourist guides. This section also deals with the requirements, the proof of competence for tourist guides that must be determined by the South African Qualifications Authority following their legislation. The rest chapter deals with matters such as the code of conduct of ethics for tourist guides which currently has in place, how to deal with complaints against tourist guides, the powers of the provincial register regarding the disqualification, it's mainly administrative justice involved in the disciplinary measures against tourist guides, and the appeals and reviews that are referred to the National Register of Tourist Guides. And in the general, normal provisions that will tell us when conduct an offense, what penalties, the regulations that the Act enjoined from the minister to pass, the laws that are repealed, and also provide for transitional conditions so that we do not coming into effect of the Act, we find ourselves in situations where we have created a vacuum, because remember the 2014 Act is created to the 1993 Act. So there's some saving provisions that are provided for many. Just to tell you a bit about the transitional provisions and the saving. The Act says upon coming into operation of the 2014 Act, members of the board are to remain as members until a date determined by the minister by instituting the Gazette, and that anything or any step that the board has taken in terms of their own text, which could have been done by the board in terms of the current act, regarding this having been done by the board in terms of the new act. Engaging in application schemes established in terms of the old act is also a thing. It doesn't mean that since we have new legislation, then whatever that has been done in terms of the old act falls off. There's also some saving provisions relating to the regulation of choice guides. So that processes are continued and to ensure that we do not lose the regulations that we have effected in terms of the regulation. We have provided honorable members for a slide or two that talk to the regulations that the act provides for. The regulations pertaining to choice guides. The two sets of regulations that are currently has in accordance with the 1993 legislation. Now the current act is saying those regulations, and mainly, as I said, they pertain to a tourist guide. The act gives the minister the power to make regulations concerning the nature and form of national tourism information and monitoring system, the categories, content and form of the data and information to capture on the system, and also any other measures that will be necessary for the proper administration and functioning of the system. Regarding the grading criteria, the grading system, the Minister does have regulation to prescribe the insignia for use and display. And the chapter that deals with tourism protection, there must be regulations on the manner and the procedure for using complaints in the tourism complaint office. Standards for responsible tourism, that is excellent, any of the national standards that will promote the object of the act and the functioning of tourism in the nation's There's also the code of conduct, code of practice that we are leading to guide conduct of audience and things responsible for developing and managing tourism. Other ones I just noticed that we need to come through. For provinces, there might be a notice when a provincial register of tourist guide is appointed, the MEC must publish a notice and the name of the person appointed as such. That also is the province appointing the national register of tourist guide. And also the name of the tourism complaint officer might be published in the government gazette. So far in terms of the implementation plan for the act, the priority project for the annual performance plan is the review of the NTSM. We will contemplate again on the regulation on tourism. So far, quite a number of frameworks that have been developed, two of which are the main procedure for the lodging of tourist complaints and also the national tourism information and monitoring system. Consultation work is underway on the framework that will show the provinces what they say in terms of how they also will want to see the national tourism information and monitoring system, taking into consideration that information may have to come from provinces as well. So very suitable that they also, when we develop a framework, we can have a discussion. Thank you,
Chair. Thank you very much. We have been workshopped on the act, and I really would like honorable members to say whatever they say, but because the honorable members say what they want to say, they must have budget for this act to be implemented. Is the budget? On the network. I say quite some time, clarity time, and the light.
Wonderful Chairperson and members, colleagues, thank you very much. Chairperson, Advocate Herman Smuts in my office was primarily responsible for certifying the vote before it became an Act of Parliament, and he retired just about a month ago after 21 years of service in my office. And so he couldn't be here today, unfortunately, and so I came along with people who had assisted him with the certification of the vote. Our job, as you know, wonderful members, to certify that a bill is consistent and compatible with the Constitution. Of course, it's just a view we express on it. And as you know, wonderful chairs and members, only the Constitutional Court can ultimately decide on the constitutionality of the bill or an act. Our role is to assist Parliament by giving Parliament the benefit of our views on the constitutionality of a bill. And in our view, at the time that we certified it, the bill, which then became an Act of Parliament, was in fact constitutional and will withstand constitutional muster. Just to be perhaps a little almost anecdotal and to share with you a few observations. The other day I walked to Parliament and I saw a tourist group. And the tourist group was being given a lecture on South Africa and on Parliament by a South African tour guide. And I paused to listen to him because I was intrigued by the body language. And he was, in fact, very disparaging of this Parliament, saying that the parliamentarians are nothing but faggots, and blah, 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 all the time.
This is the tour guy.
And saying that the parliamentarians don't actually take responsibility for the people of this country, but to go after themselves. It was so astonishing to hear from a South African tour guide. And the purpose of this act is in fact to promote the country and its interests and its people. And here was a South African tour guide actually bad-mouthing the country and Parliament to pass this law. Also, just anecdotally, I suppose, my wife and I prefer visiting tourist places in South Africa, the national park. And so my brother, who went to live in Australia many years ago, played a fleeting trip, and so we came around. And one of the places my wife and I go to regularly is Cape Horn, but we go there to swim and to enjoy the water, not really to walk to the lighthouse. And so we took my brother and his wife to the lighthouse at Cape Horn. And the first observation they made was, they said, where's the local people? We are black people. My brother and his wife were in fact black people. And he's a black tour guide. Very interesting observation. Now I say that because one of the aims of this tourism act is in fact to transform the sector and to build sustainable development through the tourist sector.
And it appears to me, if I look at Kekund, and I'm not saying it facetiously, it was an observation made by my brother, I have not completely observed, and I listened to the spur guide. It seems to me that as a country, we have a lot of work to do to properly promote our country as a tourist destination, but also to enhance the quality of the tour guides so that they accurately reflect the history of our country and they accurately present to foreigners what takes place in institutions like Parliament. So that those visitors can go back and encourage others to come here. Chairperson, we have prepared a fairly lengthy presentation which opens up largely with a very excellent presentation done by my colleagues from the department. And if you and the honourable members don't mind, I won't deviate from the presentation, but perhaps this will help the members to in fact gain a deeper insight of the Act by reinforcing what my colleagues from the department have been saying. We are also going to be of some assistance to this committee because you asked us to identify some gaps. We did do a comparison with Kenya, Uganda and Australia, but it would mean that our presentation would have been exceedingly long, so I tried to cut it down by cutting out the reference to Australia, and I think perhaps we just need to look at African countries because we are part of the African continent, and we should look at Africa to see what Africa is doing, and I thought for purposes of this presentation, I will look particularly at Kenya if you don't mind. Chairperson, if at any time you feel though that I'm going on for too long, feel free to stop me anytime. As I start with this introduction, which has already been touched on, and it raises a white paper on the development and promotion of tourism that we need to look at as the starting point. Then we also need to look at the National Development Plan, which recognizes tourism as one of the main drivers of employment. Very interestingly, of course, under Mr. Ibrahim Sell, the new growth path was developed. And the new growth path is a target of 225,000 new jobs by 2015. And you're 2015. It would be interesting to know if we have created 225,000 jobs in the tourism sector. And so the new growth path recognizes the employment potential of the tourism industry. It must address issues of quality, training, tourism, infrastructure, and youth employment industries as being the main enablers of sustainable development. My colleague has identified and touched on the Tourism Act of 1993, and I'll deal with it very, very briefly. Tourism was previously regulated by the Tourism Act of 1993. Now, that act, of course, did not address the problems that were later identified in the white paper, which had been developed post-1993. And the act had to be repealed later, of course, because it did not firstly reflect the requirements of Section 41 of the Constitution, which provides for intergovernmental cooperation. And also, it did not recognize and take into account, of course, the concurrent legislative function or competence of the provincial sphere of tourism, competence rather in tourism. And so that necessarily had to be reviewed because tourism is a concurrent competence. Now, what is the Tourism Act of number 3 of 2014 does? Firstly, as my colleague has already pointed out, it embraces the national tourism sector strategy. It was very important. The strategy was developed to guide how tourism must be developed and unfold in South Africa, and the Act embraces that. It also, as already been pointed out, gives effect to the tourism white paper and aligns the legal framework to government objectives and the Constitution. It aims to promote, probably does, sustainable tourism with social, economic, and environmental benefits of and the enjoyment thereof. South African residents and also foreign visitors. And so it has sustainable tourism, benefits of that, and we enable foreign visitors to enjoy what our country has to offer. As has been pointed out, it provides for the existence, continued existence of the tourism board. It takes a tourism complaints officer and it establishes the Tourism Grain Council of South Africa. It's interesting in our view as the law advisors that we create a tourism complaints officer because as my colleague has already pointed out from the department, there are other mechanisms through which complaints emanating from Buddhas can be dealt with. And I think the key is going to be to harmonize all of that to ensure that there's no confusion about who deals with what. It would appear to me that we're going to have to market the act and in fact develop regulations which eliminate any potential confusion. That has also been pointed out, it establishes the Tourism Grade Council and as a legal entity. In other words, when we talk about it being a legal entity, it exists in its own right, and as a legal entity, it can do and be sued. That's really what legal entity is all about. My colleague has already dealt with the purpose of the Act, and we repeat it here. We say the purpose of the Act is to provide for the development and promotion of sustainable tourism for the benefit of the public, citizens, and visitors. So in fact, Honourable Chairperson, Honourable Members, we have three purposes. So the benefit of the public as a whole, the country. And then the residents must enjoy the benefits of tourism, either through employment opportunities, or as I indicated, people like myself and you, all of us here, we must be able to enjoy the beauty of our country, what it has to offer us, in terms of relaxation and enjoyment. And visitors must come and enjoy it as well, safely and securely, and they must feel free to come to South Africa. It provides for the continued existence, as I indicated, of the South African Tourism Board, the establishment of the Tourism Grading Council, and has to regulate the tourist guide for decision that repeal certain laws and to provide for matters connected with it. A brief summary of the Act is this. It promotes responsible tourism practices and quality. In other words, it has to provide for the practices within the tourism industry. And we really don't want tour guides going around bad mouthing the country. And then it must be quality services. Suppose all of us, visitors and residents alike, must be satisfied that we get good quality for money we spend, that the facilities are satisfactory and standard, and that we're able to gain easy access to the beauty of our country. The South African tourism must market our Africa, both domestically and internationally. It means we must encourage our residents and our citizens to visit South Africa, to visit our many of my friends incidentally say it's cheaper to go and travel abroad than to live in South Africa. I don't know if that's true, it's not really in my experience, but many of my friends say it's cheaper to fly to London and go to London and to South Africa. It encourages the economic growth and development of the sector, and it establishes intergovernmental relations with developed and managed tourism. And that's really important. We have municipalities playing a part, we have the provinces playing a part, we have the national sector playing a part, and so we need to develop intergovernmental relations to ensure there's no confusion, but more importantly, to ensure that we conflicts arise, those conflicts can be dealt with properly. So in my view, the Act is really so progressive in the sense that it wants to promote tourism. If the different spheres of government say in how to promote tourism, Cape Town wants to promote Cape Town, Johannesburg wants to promote Johannesburg, the Western Cape wants to promote itself, KwaZulu-Natal wants to promote itself, but there must be no conflict in how we do all of that. And so in short, the national government has a very important role to play in regulating the sector properly, and my colleague has already touched on that. What is the response to tourism? It's defined in the Act as tourism that seeks to avoid negative economic, environmental, and social impacts. Many years ago, I was in the Philippines, and many of the women's organizations that took me around in the Philippines took me to the red light district, and they say New Zealand men and Australian men basically average age around about 40 come here for sex tourism. And they say they in fact want children, they want young girls, they want 8 and 9, 12, 13 years old, and they want virgins. Extraordinary. And the big issue in the Philippines was that it's an issue that the countries of the world must take up because the children, the women were at risk. And they asked us to in fact take up the issue in South Africa. And so when we talk about responsible tourism, I suppose we want to avoid a negative economic environment and social impacts. In other words, we don't want our children and our youth exploited in tourism or exploited under the guise of tourism. It talks about generating greater economic benefits for local people, in other words, our people, that make positive contributions to the conservation of natural and cultural heritage, and it would lead to a greater understanding of local cultural, social, and environmental issues. And if you look around the country, that in each province that is being done, the culture of different provinces is emphasized, and it's even must promote that. What does the minister do? The minister must, by noticing the cadets and after following the consultation process contemplated in substitute, he adopts a national tourism sector strategy to promote the objects of the day. And my colleague has already spoken about that. National tourism and monitoring information system must be developed, and a database record must record information of tourism businesses subject to the regulations made about the type of information that must be recorded. In our view, and I'm trying to shorten this, section 7 is quite important, because section 7 regulatory must be norms and standards for practicing responsible tourism, achieving excellence in the tourism sector and promoting the objects of the Act and the provisioning of tourism information services to the public. The norms and standards contemplated may relate to matters such as the form of business hours, facilities that must be available, staff and training requirements, information and displays, and the signage and identification that must be used, among others. This committee and the department may want to look at other norms and standards which may perhaps not be catered for, and which perhaps may not have been taken into consideration at the time that the bill was developed. Then, Section 8 is also important, and my colleague has dealt very well with that already, but I'll just mention it here. It provides a code of good practice issued by the Minister to guide conduct related to tourism services, facilities and products. Basically it means that people who visit our country, travel around the country, must feel good about the country and the services offered, the price and the way that it's treated, and the code of good practice must do that. The code of the guide the conduct of organs of state responsible for developing and managing tourism, it must also promote the achievement of the objects of the Act. In other words, all organs of state involved in the tourism industry must be regulated by that code of conduct. Chapter 3 provides for the continuous improvement, as has already been pointed out by my colleague of the South African Tourism Board. I don't need to say anything else about that, but also to emphasize again that the Public Finance Management Act applies to that as well. The grade system that the Act talks about is given to the Minister to develop. With a view to maintaining or enhancing the standards and quality of tourism services, facilities and products. The grading system must promote the objects of the Act, the National Tourism Sector Strategy, and excellence in the tourism services, facilities and products. And the grading system must provide for the establishment of one of the schemes in terms of which tourism services, facilities and products are graded or classified by the tourism. It also makes provision for tourism protection. And I suppose that's very important, Honourable Chairperson, because if you want tourists to come here, then they must be protected. They must be protected in many ways. But I mean, must be safety and security be secured. And that's the issue alluded to by my colleagues from the department. I think that they want protection in terms of how the money is spent. They don't want to be overcharged. They don't want to get poor services. And so this makes provision for tourism protection. And one of the ways in which this Act aims to achieve that is through the appointment of a tourism compliance officer. And that person must monitor the effectiveness of any accredited scheme or arrangement and may require the person responsible for the implementation of an accredited scheme or arrangement to provide such information as may be reasonably necessary for the purpose of such monitoring. At the risk of repeating myself, I simply want to indicate again that my colleague did touch on that and indicated that they were liaising with the different sectors involved in making that complaint. In respect of the tourist guide, you notice as well that the Act makes provision for the regulation of the tourist guide position, and that's also been touched on. What's of course important is that the NEC in each province has a role to play as well, and makes provision for the procedure that needs to be followed by the provincial registered province one has to apply to become a registered tourist guide. In Section 53, which is very lengthy, deals with the procedure for the reporting of contraventions and the lodging of complaints. And some of those contraventions are the following, and I'm not going to deal with all of that because they're up there and people are aware of liability. But a person is not a registered tour guide, or the registration has been suspended, or withdrawn may not fully reward after the tourist guide. That's very important. I suppose, challenge that we're going to have as a country is to enforce that. There's so many millions of tourists coming here, so many people offering those services. The question is, how are you properly going to monitor that? And if no person who has become subject to this quarantine is referred in Section 73, they can work with a manager or otherwise act as a tourist guide. And so the same thing applies to a closed corporation as well. And then it makes provision for the disqualification of a tourist guide and also means that the provincial interest form must institute an investigation or an investigation is being instituted if that person has news that the tourist guide is guilty of misconduct. The Act makes provision for appeals and reviews, and if I recall correctly, my colleague from the department is not here yet. Section 56 provides any person who is relieved by the decision of the provincial registrar may appeal against the decision and question the national registrar. The appellant may argue he will appeal personally or to an advisor of his choice, and the national registrar may confirm set aside against the decision. The power to determine and appeal in terms of this section is not restricted to the merits of the decision appealed against, but includes the power to review any irregularity regarding the decision. In other words, we provide a cheap, easy, quick method, and that's the beauty of the session, for people of grief by the decision of provincial registrar, in fact, the feeling bear in mind. So it does not take away the right of the person who approach the court to law for relief as well. The process is a quick, easy session to use, and will probably be used quite often by people who are grieved. Any dispute between the national registrar and the provincial registrar concerning the performance of any function must be dealt with in accordance with the principles of cooperative governance and in terms of the Intergovernmental Relations Framework Act. I don't need to deal more fully with that interest on this committee because you are familiar with it. Chapter 7, of course, creates outlines the general provisions of the Act. It speaks about census and penalties, delegations, regulations, repeal of law, and the provisional provisions. In my simple view, the penalties appear to be quite low. And they're not necessarily penalties which may generally discourage people from committing unlawful acts. May not necessarily make people feel that they're not going to act as tourist guides if they're not properly accredited. But I say that just because the penalties when you compare it with other roads seem to be quite low, but possibly the department of parliament knows exactly why that is so. For example, a penalty for the closed corporation is only 100,000 rand. Some of these were operators of very, 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 very large, and the penalty for the 100,000 may be more change for a very, very large corporation. And if you just go back to some of the things in the tourism act, the Tourism Act says that this Act, now the Tourism Act includes the norms and standards and the regulations, and they belong, but we were not able to find norms and standards as contemplated in Section 7, but my colleague from the department will talk about that. And as far as we were able to establish, the current regulations were promulgated in terms of the repeal Tourism Act of 1993, and so we possibly need to look at the new regulations in quickly. And of course my office is ready to assist the department in that regard. In order to facilitate any effective implementation and administration of normal standards as well as the new regulations are required, and my colleague has touched on that. Section 61 deals with the regulations, and I don't need to go over that again. And then there's a short discussion on some of the sections in the Act. And I'll go through them very, very quickly. The Section 8 provides for the minister to develop a rating system with a view to maintaining and monitoring the standards and quality of goods and services, facilities and products. In our view, a very good and in fact an excellent section. This affects the function of the council in terms of Section 8 and the duties of chief quality assurance officer. And the absence of the notice in this regard may be seen as a gap in the implementing of the act, and we can explain that earlier. Section 47 provides that the tourism officer must deal with it in the way it's outlined in. And the manner in which the tourism officer may deal with the complaint should be prescribed in regulations to give effect to the proper functioning of it. So the regulations, in our view, on the chairperson and the minister, is going to be quite important. taken certain important research on it, as my colleague, no person may be registered in Purga. That person has failed for pre-drive quality assurance process that the wearer's card must complete not later than 2 years after the date of his or her last registration as a wearer's card. The regulation that promulgated in terms of the EU Tourism Act of 1993 does not provide for the quality assurance process that the wearer's card must complete. And then Section 52 deals with the National Register, and we wanted to go on to that, and the regulations in respect of 52, Section 52, that is of importance, so as to guide all registered tour guides. And so, in respect of that, there is a number of things which, in our view, whereby it's possible to still be done, but of course, the decision of whether that should be done is, of course, determined by the department, it's their function, but we are ready, willing, and able to assist them. We thought that we would just briefly deal with the Kenya Tourism Act. And the reason we do so is because in looking at the Kenya Tourism Act, it seems that that act would be similar. In fact, it's probably the most similar to the South African Act. And so I'll deal with it very briefly. The object of that act, that is the Kenya Tourism Act, is to provide for development, management, marketing, and regulation of sustainable tourism and tourism-related activities and services, and for connected businesses. So you see the object seems to be slightly different, similar but slightly different to us. The sector can rely on also an outdated and fragmented policy and legal instruments that needed to define it. And the socio-economic, geopolitical, environmental and technological forces are changing to produce new concepts of the tourism business. Unplanned expansion of accommodation facilities in key areas and the need for harmonization of policy and legislation also necessitated for tourism towards Kenya of engineering. And let me give you a short comparison between South Africa and Kenya, and you'll see that it's more or less similar. And I don't need to be further with that. The tourism industry in Kenya has traditionally had 7 active private sector bodies representing the association of tour operations, hotel people, caterers, travel agents, care operators, Mombasa and coast tourism, and eco-tourism in Kenya. And Kenya Tourism Federation's primary objective was to unite the 7 associations under one umbrella. I suppose you can't have a fragmented sector when you want to promote tourism, and I think here in South Africa we've been aware of that for a really, really long time. And so as the federation provides single votes, it enhances ethical standards, it strengthens private sector representations of the body, provides a forum through which the industry can give input to the marketing activities, and it can lobby and constructively engage government on issues critical to the industry. Incidentally, that lobbying thing isn't something that emerges in our legislation. Rather, the emphasis appears to be on intergovernmental cooperation. But perhaps it's there somewhere, but I don't know. And it appears that in Kenya, it sees that the capability of the private sector to engage with government on critical issues is important, and that's what this body tries to do in Kenya. The following issue is not specifically mentioned in the Africa's Tourism Act, but is covered by Kenya's Tourism Act. And it must account for audit provisions, tourism, licensing, tourism, media, and tax. The Kenya College, the Kenyatta International Convention Center, the Tourism Fund, the Tourism Finance Corporation, and the Tourism Foundation. What does that mean for us? We may want to look at whether we need to include the convention centers in Cape Town, in Durban, and Janison, and Chelsea, within the Tourism Act of the regulations. And so we say, not specifically mentioned, but natively somewhere, but we don't know. Then we thought that we'd touch on, and my colleague from the department has not done so. What is the big issue a while ago? Is there conflict between the Tourism Act and the immigration regulations? And you will recall that the Western Cape government was particularly concerned about the immigration regulations and asked Minister Kijara to address them on the issue. And so the real issue was really who did the immigration regulations impact negatively on tourism. And I suppose because we don't have any knowledge of that, the jury is probably still out there. But I did notice that both the Minister of Tourism and the Minister of Home Affairs in the newspaper media reports appear to speak with one voice on the issue. And I thought that you highlight just one aspect of it. Maybe because of my experience many, many years ago in the Philippines, where they were very concerned about the use of children and the trafficking of children. And so one of the issues raised was Regulation 12 in 27 of the immigration regulations that might negatively impact on tourism. And as a law advisor, we passed no comment on those regulations except to detail what they actually say. And I'll deal with this fully very shortly. Regulation 12, as we've indicated up there, provides as follows. With parents traveling with a child, such parents must produce an unabridged birth certificate of the child, reflecting the particulars of the fears of the child. And in the case of one parent traveling with a child, he or she must produce an unabridged birth certificate and the things listed there. And where a person is traveling with a child who is not his or her biological child, he or she must do the following. Produce a copy of the unabridged birth certificate. And that it comes from parents or legal guardian of the child confirming that he or she has permission to travel with the child. Copies of the identity documents or passport for the parent or legal guardian and the contact details for the parent or legal guardian of the child. Chapter 17 and 18 of the Children's Act provide as follows. If a court has a reason to believe that the parent or guardian of the child or any other person who has parental responsibilities and rights to respect for the child is traffic the child or allow the child to be trafficked, the court has spent all parental responsibilities and rights to the parent, guardian or other person and places the child in temporary safety attending an inquiry by a children's court. It appears that the contingent provisions in Regulation 12 A, B and C, the immigration regulation, are an attempt to prevent child abductions and child trafficking dealing with South Africa's obligations under the aforementioned international treaties. As stated above, the Regulation 12 does not conflict with any provision in the Tourism Act as far as we can see. Regulation 27 makes provision for circumstances under which a person may be declared an undesirable person. The provision of Regulation 27 claims for the reason that I was recently. The outcome of which of the case is as follows. And Chairperson, honourable members, you will recall that those were the cases of Johnson and DeLory and other business among them, Mr. Lowe's opinion. The two applicants were similar tax approach to this. Both applicants were holders of peace temporary resident permits. Both applicants owed state period, their temporary resident permits allowed on leaving the country on an overseas trip. They were both issued with a notice. These notices declared it to be undesirable persons. The effect of the notice is that both could not return to the country. Before the implementation of a new legal regime that declared each of them an undesirable person, they could have left the country and applied on the outside for a fresh permit if they failed to obtain a residence permit while in South Africa. The only consequence was an administrative fine. The new legal dispensation excluded them from coming back. The applicants also urgently needed to allow the respective spouses and the child to return to the country. The order allowed both applicants to return to the country and the court made the following finding in respect of each of the applicants. It says the following. The applicants are plainly suffering prejudice and have no alternative reasonably available to them other than a release for development of motion. The affected persons in both instances do not pose a threat to the security of the country and in fact no such threat is related to the payment. Thus the return of the affected applicants to the country should pose no threat to any person. Thus in my view says the court balance of convenience plainly favors the granting of the released source. But that was not actually the end of the matter, because the Minister of Home Affairs then appealed to the matter, and the court had indicated in the fine that they should not. The court indicated the following. The Constitutional Court held that I could only have a temporary peace for South African in that court. He did not deal with the legislation itself, and he did not challenge the validity of the legislation. As such, said the Constitutional Court, the High Court did not dispose of any factual or legal issue. The Constitutional Court held that it was not in the interest of justice to hear the matter, and the application was costly. In other words, what the Constitutional Court was saying is that on the basis of papers before it, there was no constitutional issue that would be determined. Conclusion is that it would seem wrong that there is no conflict between any provisions in the Tourism Act, the new one, and the Regulation 26. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Advocate Daniel. Do any of the lawyers want to add on something?
Thank you. Chairman says, you know, I've sat in the past even the office of Chief Chamberlain, where I've made survey presentations. I definitely agree.
On that note, thank you very much. Advocate Daniel, can you share your load with us so that we can have for peace? Because it will enrich us on understanding the Act and how best that we can interact with the Act.
What we'll do is we'll email it to the Secretary of the Committee immediately after this. And this is why, while I can give you a slide, the presentation, the memorandum is not in the format I think it's due to this committee. I have both an empty memorandum, and I haven't dealt with the whole of it, and also anything, the slide presentation that I'll email immediately after this.
Thank you very much. Department, do you have anything else to add before we engage?
We don't quite have something to add, but we would like to submit that we use as much of this time that we've got as possible to provide as much detail on the Tourism Act as we possibly can. There will be other issues that indicate the broader tourism environment, but that are probably not necessarily within the confines of this Tourism Act. And I also want to submit that there will be matters that are matters of policy, that as officials some instances we may not be in a position to pronounce on, because it probably isn't a position that is already pronounced on.
Thank you very much. On that happy note, honorable members, the board is in your court. Honorable Adam.
I don't know what to ask. It's quite intimidating with a whole bunch of lawyers in front of us. But if they could... get some clearance on the use of some words. The words may and might. If you approach to the intake of the law at the end here, under chapter 5, there's section 45 reads as follows: the minister may. And 46, the tourism complaint officer may. Then you go to chapter 6, and then it says the minister must. Why may and must? That's the first question. The other one is, if you could explain to me this term of concurrency. Because, but there must be appointed can I come back? I just want to find, I want that, I don't want to delay, but you can give me a second chance after the last one, so I just want to look for it in my notes. Yes.
Okay, Honorable Adams, you can put your thoughts. Next hand. Points of clarity. Good
one. Where did it take? I'll come back to your counsel.
Honorable members are still thinking. But in the meanwhile, department, this act has a fully fledged budget to implement.
Honorable citizen, it's going to be implemented over the medium, well, let me say, over the medium term allocation. As we get the MTF, there will be assets that will be able to implement. The important thing is that we must prioritize the most critical aspect. As a result, the service guide regulations, those are highly prioritized. What we refer to as Data Peak, which basically is the National Tourism Information and Monitoring System, that is prioritized. The methods that pertain to the complaint officer and how that environment gets regulated, that is prioritized. So there will be assets that would then form what the lawyers refer to as the law reform program of the department. And there will be other things that we'll do now, there will be other things that we'll do later.
Thank you very much. Honorable Rumbug.
Thanks, Chair. You gave us a few moments just to prepare and think. Can I just ask, in point of clarity, are you inviting questions at this stage on the last part of the previous presentation as well, which is the effect of these new regulations on tourism, or is that not yet up for discussion?
It's not yet up for that discussion. It's just for this current one that we workshopped on. And if there are questions for the lawyers, they also can be asked them.
Well, yeah, I mean, a very short question. I don't want to make any emphasis. This is more questions for clarity, which might help us follow on when we continue. But I noticed that the presenter said something along the lines that there isn't any clear evidence whether, in fact, these new regulations have had as an impact on tourism. My understanding was that there's already been a very profound impact on tourism numbers coming in to this country, inbound tourism. The fact that the two ministers' concerns might have been at rhythm on the issue is neither here nor there. One expects that there's a certain amount of cabinet collegiality on these matters. But surely what we should be looking at is whether, in fact, we as a committee believe that they have had an impact. If so, what is the impact? And then, if it's significant, what we should be doing about it. But we can't even have the debate unless there's common cause about the facts. Before we can have opinions, which is legitimate, but listen to him, is we must at least have agreed to the facts. So I would like to clarify on that, because it was my very clear understanding on official figures published by the department that already had quite a negative impact, which is significant in nature. So can we just clear that up so we don't get sidetracked as to what the facts are? Once we establish the facts, we can have a discussion.
You want clarity from the department? Department?
I will attempt to provide some clarity. But I must say that the environment within which we operate does not only get affected by this specific set of regulations only. It's affected by transport legislation. It's affected by legislation from trade industries. It's affected by legislation pertaining to health standards or including safety standards and so on from the Department of Labor. So all these different legislative environments have an impact in one way or another in terms of what we do. The current relief of tourism that we have seen from South Africa, we have seen that there is an increase. That's the total figures. But we have been very cautious on immediate reaction to the figures without proper detailed analysis of what is actually coming out of those figures. And that would include having an understanding of whether the reclassification that has been done by Statistics South Africa also has an impact on the numbers that have actually been projected. Specifically, Honorable Chairperson, the category referred to as transit. Now, that particular category, when we look at the figures, those figures have actually been they have withdrawn that particular classification. So the withdrawal of that particular classification, we do not know at this point in time, and we're trying to go through the detailed papers, literally going through the papers. We want to have a better understanding of whether that declassification, in one way or another, could have actually had a direct impact. And as we go deeper, we'll be able to say, this is what it actually means. And if there is indeed evidence pointing to whichever direction, obviously that will be contained in the communication. So that process is underway. And then the colleagues are hard at work with Statistics South Africa as well as Southern Journalism to get to that level of detail.
Thank you. Just a follow-up. I find that answer difficult to process because I'm on record here over a long period of time in my previous tenure with the committee in putting on the record my appreciation and admiration for the statistical deficiency of this department. We get, I think, some of the best reports in Parliament from the Department of Tourism, which are well-researched, which are very carefully researched, and they have to be because we're talking about a major, major industry which has been earmarked as one of the key drivers going forward, by no less than the president himself. And we always get quality statistical information, particularly from the department, to digest and to look at. And one of the things that department does is brand positivity testing. We actually look in every single country, and they isolate the factors, and they measure the factors. What causes people to come here, and what also puts them off. And you might know, Chair, but we've asked several questions in the recent months about what has caused the shift in those positivity ratings, particularly in Australia and the Far East. And my colleague, Honourable Fox, has also asked similar questions and made similar inputs. So I can't believe that suddenly now we don't actually know and we can't identify which factors are negative and to what extent, because that's exactly what we've been measuring for the last number of years, in fact, probably goes before my time on this committee. So I would really urge that process continues because for some other reason it stopped. Right now, we brought in this other legislation in the National Home Affairs, and I really want to request from you, Chair, that we get a report based on the very same research methodology and the very same methods that have been so brilliantly presented and researched at this very committee, and we're actually told precisely what is the weighting of each component factor, whether it's positive or negative, on an impact of these particular sets of new regulations on our tourism figures, because we have the ability to actually measure that. It has been measured for many, many years. I don't understand why now we can't find out. It just doesn't fit well with us, I don't think.
Hi,
thank you, Jason. Honourable Member, you may direct the question that we have, but I'm not certain that I dealt with Immigration Act and the Immigration And what I made clear was that we looked at the Immigration Act and we compared it with the Tourism Act to see if there was any conflict that needed to be addressed. Because one of the things that we were asked to do today is to look at the gaps. And so we dealt with the things which we think are most topical, and that is trafficking. And people who are in the country and want to leave the country and want to come back into the country, and people who have children, and so we chose specific sections, and we could not find the conflict. Of course. And often we find in legislation that we deal with much later, Parliament or a department gets the attention of Parliament or the department, either to us, it is pointed up to us that there were unintended consequences, there may be unintended consequences. But of course, as a law advisor, we don't always pick up those unintended consequences. But often in the course of our certification, and when presentations are made to us, people point out that there may be unintended consequences. And that happens in different types of legislation. But as far as we are concerned, as a law advisor, we look at the immigration regulations, and we look at that, and we can find the conflict. But you're not talking about the conflict, you are talking about the impact which the regulations have on tourism. So I can't deal with that.
And I think with the international arrivals or tourists, there's also been the problem of Ebola. And people were not so keen to come down here because of Ebola from what we had. But that might have been a slight issue. I think DG would like to say something. And if people have managed to sort their questions, then we can talk about it the same day.
Thank you, I want to share that. And I just wanted to provide a little bit of clarity on the questions that were raised by Uncle Kumba with regards to the statistical issue. If one was to take, I'm going to use this as an example, the figures from Brazil. If you've got the figures that are inclusive of people in transit, that would be about 82,802 people that would have actually come here from Brazil. If you remove the people that were part of the transit, people who spent a night or more at any of the facilities in South Africa, but they're also going elsewhere, that would come to about 45,808. That's almost actually half of it. But we do know that there is a whole number of establishments that are even at our port of entry, specifically at the one time in that particular system. And these people have actually made a particular input into the economy. So that's why I'm saying this is Parliament. I don't want to be on record as saying there is an increase or is a decrease, when we have not gone through that level of detail and be in a position to actually provide you with a non-anecdotal answer to this particular question, and we will provide that.
The acting DJ, you are being very cautious. Honorable AC.
Thank you, Chair. I would very like to start with African Daniel's comment about a tour guide who called a fat cat. I would say that's probably one of those guys that sits back and expect his financial sustainability relies on the input from these very fat cats or this government. Madam Chair, one or two things on chapter 3. I think the former of tourism, the role of the Department of Tourism is a bit watered down by this Tourism Organization Conventions Bureau. But this actually provides for a lot of people. The total of 177 bits or events for this financial period, which also exceeded more than 250,000 people will visit this country, and an economic impact of more than 3.5 billion rand, which is quite a bit. You just mentioned Ebola and other things that have an impact, and I also think that South African Airways, the airlift that we have from strategic places like Beijing and China, and think now that South African Airways has cut back on their flight, is going to have an impact on this as well, on this industry. Honorable Forth here looked at my notes and he said, that's old news, it's a sports event. I just want to say, that he's actually willing to do topless mud wrestling with up to 5 girls, and he thinks that that would draw more than from this to send their son in a cheek. The tour guides that the only regulated sector of the touring industry, there's a lot of volunteers that work at the heritage site that doesn't really know what I'm talking about. How is this regulated? They're not really interested as well for that matter. I've made notes all over. The requirement for families traveling with children to produce an unabridged birth certificate that comes in effect June 1. Has the TVCSA had follow-up meetings with Home Affairs since Sona, where the President said that this will be under review? Is there any time frame for this now? June 1 is what the date said. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Honorable Adam.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just a quick and more simple question on the law. Page 20. page 20, article 24. The chief executive officer is responsible for the efficient management of business. Then, 25.2, the board and the chief executive officer must conclude a performance agreement. Is that standard practice must the chief executive officer start working before there is an agreement or after there is an agreement? And I need it is the agreement is only concluded after he started to work. Then on page 5% of the presentation from the department on the vision. A united, sustainable and competitive tourism industry in South Africa will lead to global best practice in socially, environmentally and culturally responsible tourism. One recognizes the following about tourism. The third bullet, lack of inclusive, effective national, provincial and local structures for the management of tourism. Now I want to know, I didn't read any engagement with local structures. How are they engaged into this bullet there before us? Then the other one, you had 400 and something consultations. Does that include people, not people in the trade, but people from the society? You had 450 comments received. Were there only people in the tourism industry? Did you try to engage people not in the tourism industry? That why we become part of the tourism. Because that's what we want to do. We want to transform this section. And what have you done to transform this section? The last one, Jefferson, is on the implementation plan regulations on the slide 30. Notices in terms of the Act 2014, I didn't read anyway on slide 30. Notice to publish the name of the National Register of Tourist Guides, Tourism Complaint of the Provincial Register of Tourist Guides. Is there a time frame, a due date for appointment of these persons? Because if you want to implement this act, these people must be appointed. And then, dear person, it's a grey area for me, the work of the complaints officer. What kind of complaints is he or she going to Jesus? Will he or she be there to direct some legal complaints to safety departments? Or what precise is the work of this complaint officer? I didn't read it. If you could show me where it is in the act, what kind of complaint will he or she look at? Thank you, Jefferson.
Maybe from the department, I may just like to follow up the number of jobs that have been established now that it is 2015.
Honorable Chairman, thank you. There's been considerable progress in terms of job creation since we started, which is approximately around 2010 or so. At that time, whilst there have been changes in the environment in terms of the various institutions and so on, we are now at 655,609 people that are employed directly by the sector. And this figure, reference period is 2013. We will always be at least a year out in terms of the figures because there is a cost for at least slightly a year back. So we are actually making very, very good progress in that regard. These are direct jobs. This has got nothing to do with our EDWPs and all those other indirect employments and so on. And then if we use the WCTC figures, the World Travel and Tourism Council figures, which is inclusive of the indirect jobs as well, it's way above the 1.4 million people that are employed in this sector. And by comparison, I mean, if we take the mining sector, it's just under 500,000 people that are employed directly in it. So they use very, very good progress in that regard to the creation of jobs. It comes to around almost 4.4% of employment overall in the country. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair, honourable members. Just in respect of the question relating to the use of the word may and must, I know sometimes it can be tricky when one reads legislation, but generally when the word may is used in legislation, usually indicates that the functionary will have a discretion basically to enforce or to do something. But on the other hand, it can also be, depending on the context, to have an empowering provision, allowing the functionary to do something in order to give effect to the intention of the legislature. And in this regard, we're dealing with Chapter 5, which Section 45 deals with the designation of the Tourism Complaints Officer. Now, in this regard, Section 45.1 empowers the Minister to designate a suitably qualified officer of the department as a Tourism Complaints Officer, and then the Minister must then publish his or her name in the Gazette. So basically, in that regard, the Minister is empowered to appoint or to designate this person from the department as the Tourism Complaints Officer. But in order for the Minister to be set to the function of the Tourism Complaints Officer, there are certain duties that the Tourism Complaints Officer must comply with. And that's dealt in 45.2. The Tourism Complaints Officer must perform the functions referred to in Section 46 and must deal with complaints, any complaints received in respect of the tourism services, facilities or products in the manner provided for in Section 47. So the functions relate to two sections, Section 46, which deals with the accreditation of scheme, and Section 47, which deals with the duties that impose on the Tourism Complaints Officer. First, the accreditation of the scheme, the Tourism Complaints Officer, in this regard, the word is used may on his own initiative or in response to a proposal from persons conducting business within a particular tourism sector, recommend to the Minister first the recommendation of the accreditation of a particular scheme or arrangement established for a particular tourism sector to resolve tourist complaints. Secondly, the person responsible for the implementation of the scheme or arrangement. So, in that regard, when the circumstances dictate that the Tourism Complaint Officer will, on his own initiative, first on his own initiative, or in response to proposal from business conducting businesses from a particular sector, in that regard, the Tourism Complaint Officer must recommend to the Minister the accreditation of a particular scheme. But that process is dealt with further in 46.2, which says that the scheme of arrangement contemplated in subsection 1 must be consistent with the Act, so it must be in the parameters of the Act, and it must be consistent with the Consumer Protection Act that deals with the protection of consumers, and also must comply with such requirements as may be prescribed. So the Minister will, by his regulations, prescribe further requirements for the accreditation of a particular scheme in that regard. Once that process has been finalized, then the Minister will then, the consultation has been finalized, compliance with the regulations has been finalized, then the Minister is empowered in by notice of motion, in the Gazette to accredit or a scheme or arrangement, and also the Minister is also empowered to amend the accreditation on the recommendation of the complaints officer. And then the Tourism Complaints officer has further functions, in 46.4, indicates that the Tourism Complaints Officer must monitor the effectiveness of any scheme or arrangement and may require the person responsible for the implementation of an accredited scheme or an arrangement to provide such information as may be reasonably necessary for the purpose of such monitoring. So basically that empowers the tourism complaint officer to require them the information needed. Now section 47 also deals with the duties of the tourism complaint officer. The honourable member requested the reference as to where the duty is located. It's found in section 47 as well, where it says duties of the tourism complaint officer in respect of tourist complaints. Now section 1, also just one section, it reads, upon receiving a complaint in respect of any tourism services, facility or product, the tourism complaint officer must do the following. For the purpose of resolving the complaint, refer the complaint to an accredited scheme or arrangement contemplates the section 46. Now that process will really be settled in terms of the process set up in section 46, which I've just now discussed. And then B, may refer complaint, must refer the complaint to the National Consumer Commission, the Provincial Consumer Protection Authority or Consumer Court contemplates the Consumer Protection Act. If the tourism complaint officer believes that the issues raised by the complaint can be dealt with expeditiously and fully by the body concerned. And C, the complaint officer must also refer the complaint to the South African Police Service if the complaint alleges that a person has committed an offence. So in the case of an offence, it will be referred to the police services to be dealt with. Then D, must also refer the complaint to the Equality Court, referred to Section 6 of the Promotion of Equality and Prevention of Unfair Discrimination Act, 2000, if the complaint alleges unfair discrimination against a tourist, and then parameters will be set in terms of the Equality Act in that regard. E, refer the complaint to another regulatory authority with jurisdiction over the matter. It could be another matter related with another sector. And then the tourism complaint officer must then refer to the relevant regulatory authority, or matter will be dealt with will deal with the matter in the prescribed manner. So there could be other matters which could also have an impact, and those matters could be dealt with by way of regulations will be prescribed and published by the minister in that regard. That on the word you. Must and may
I wanted them to explain to me. Chapter 5 reads, the minister may designate. Chapter 6 reads, the minister must support. Why may the one and must the other? That's what I want to know. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Can you help?
Thank you, Chair. I think I when I started with the explanation of the use of the word "use may," depending on the context of the section of the legislation that we're dealing with, it could mean that it's in parting provision. That means the minister must be effective in order to check to the content of the particular section. So in that regard, it would actually be a must. It should be interpreted as a must. So that's why I indicated when I started with the meaning of the word use and may, Ascalus basically indicated that it could also mean a must. That means the minister must give effect to it. And that's why I said it's an empowering provision. And in order to read the context of Chapter 5, it can only be that the minister must in those circumstances. When you look at the functions of Section 46, if you look at the functions of Section 47, the minister would be obliged to appoint the tourism complaints officer in that regard. In Section 48, which the honourable member now referred to, in this regard, the word must is used, but in this regard, the minister is obligated, which is more or less the same. In the context which I explained, the May under 45, 46, which I've explained, in this regard, the minister must appoint a suitably qualified officer. Now, this is now in the department as a national registrar for the student guide and publish his or name in the grid. And then he takes up his functions as well. So, in Chapter 5, we're dealing with accreditation. schemes and where it can be initiated in respect of it can be an initiation by the tourism companies, or it could be from a proposal received from persons conducting business within a particular sector. So in that regard, if you look at 6, it's clear that it's a must, but if you look at the word may, the way it's used, it's also an empowering provision that the minister will have to give effect to section 45 on we must appoint them. If you have this case, must appoint the tourism complaint officer in that regard. Okay. It's a the interpretation of views and how legislation is read to a certain extent. It can be confusing to a certain extent. Yeah. Thank you, Chair.
Mr. Pastor, thank you for your hand.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. Just to say, I think that as the department and as the minister, as the sector for doing compliance, the registrar for tourist guides has been appointed even under the conditions of the old Act, and that part of the conditional agreement, that the acting DG, who is the DG, also responsible for that. In the case of the compliance officer, that has also been directed by the minister, and Mr. Dong Sitwaba, who is also the Chief Director for Legal Services, is the Complaint Officer. So those are the provisions are in place, and I think as indicated by herself, as far as the complaints is concerned, the framework are in place. I think the specific reference that was made to the chapter, that needs to also be taken care of the Consumer Protection Act, because that overrides the part that we will fulfill within the Tourism Act that used to not be in the old Act. So something new that we sort of brought in to accommodate the need that arose of saying how we deal with tourism. An interest perhaps on Honourable Adam's question around the consultation process. I can say this was quite an extensive process. We had visited all the provinces in certain areas to sort of very rural areas. More specific also when we worked with the HLP, that there was meetings held in all the provinces. And in fact, on a technical point, 8 of the 9 provinces concurred with the legislation as stands. So it's only a technical issue that in the HLP there was that one province could not have sort of been dealt with at that stage, and that was concluded at the other meeting. So in fact there was full agreement around that. So the 450 that we referred to, that was a written comment where specific implicated organizations or people have suggestions of how to deal with certain things. And as the acting DG has indicated, in certain areas there was the feeling by industry they would like to bring things into this act that are not applicable or lies in the responsibility field of the minister responsible for tourism. Like for argument's sake, matters related to the amount of people that needs to be carried in tourist bus and those types of, that's been regulated by something else. I think that's just to say that we've dealt with that, and that the compliance part as far as the implementation of those must have happened, and that's underway. Then on the matter that was raised by Honourable Head President on the Coordination Bureau, just to say that when the new department was established in 2009 and became operational in 2010, instructions were given that we need to sort of focus on how we can best utilize the conventions as a mechanism to also accommodate tourism. So that's an, I think the figures that have been indicated that have already shown the sort of issues about that. So the Convention Bureau is being assigned as a function of the South African Tourism Board, and it's now listed in there. So the funding has been earmarked there, and I think as DJ has indicated up front, saying that those things we are undertaking at this stage in relation to the Act are funded. We've got funded mandate to that. Last year, we have submitted to Treasury 2 proposals. One is the creation of a fund for the Convention Bureau. So that's under discussion, and when the Treasury has got sufficient funds for that, that's something that needs to come in, because that can leverage even more the objectives of the convention bureau. So that, I think that is it. But convention bureau is tourism related, so we need to be clear on that. It does not impinge on either provincial or other departments where they are dealing with issues related to their mandates. Thank you, Anderson.
Thank you very much. Can we have final words from the legal team, final words from the department, DD, and then we call it a day after. Thank you. Legal?
Yes. It's just one outstanding question, Honorable Adams, of with regard to the performance agreement of Chief Executive Officer. I see in terms of the Section 24, it provides for the appointment of the Chief Executive Officer of the Board, but that appointment must be in concurrence with the Minister. So the Board and the Minister will sign together with regard to who will be a suitably qualified person as a appointed as a Chief Executive Officer. And with regard to the performance contract and agreement, that agreement will be in terms of the conditions and the policies determined in terms of Section 27.1. So the Board will have certain conditions and policies with regard to the remuneration policies of the Board and the appointment of staff. So that will then take that person, the Chief Executive Officer, will be then appointed in terms of those policies. But Section 25 deals specifically then with the contract itself. It says that the Board and the Chief Executive Officer must conclude a written contract of employment. And that contract of employment must then contain the forms and the requirements of Section 57 of the Public Finance Management Act. So in that act sets out particular duties that must also be complied with, because it's a public entity and because there are certain requirements in terms of the PFMA for sound management purposes. Now, those requirements will also be incorporated in the contract. Now, it also further states in 25.2, the Board and the Chief Executive Officer must conclude a performance agreement as soon as reasonably practicable. So as soon as possible, but then the legislature also says that within 3 months of the appointment of Chief Executive Officer. So the first appointment, basically, will be that contract, that performance agreement must be concluded no later than 3 months after the appointment. And there could be various reasons for that. The Board could have certain requirements which must be considered, which must be discussed, or for any other practical reason to be linked to the appointment, and so to contain that relationship, to reduce that in writing, there could be time needed for that purpose. But that's for the first appointment. And then in 22B, it says, thereafter, annually within 1 month of the commencement of each financial year. So that could also be, there could be assessments that must be done, there could be some sort of proposals for a change in the contract. So there's a 1 month period then after the first year of appointment that those that contract must then be compliant. And then 25.3, it sets up more detail with regard to what must be concluded in the performance agreement. The performance agreement must include a measurable work performance objective and targets that must be met by the Chief Executive Officer, and the time frame within which those performance objectives and targets must be met. It says it must also include standards and procedures for evaluating the work performance of the Chief Executive Officer and interval for evaluation and consequences for substandard work performance. That means poor work performance. So your initial appointment, that will is a period not more than 3 months, and then thereafter within 1 month. And then subsection 25.3 sets out basically what must be included in terms of the performance agreement, being in mind compliance of the Public Finance Management Act with regard to the Chief Executive Office of Chief Financial. Thank you. Yeah. With regard to the concurrency question, if we look at Schedule 4 of the Constitution, which deals with functional areas concurrent national provincial legislative competence, tourism is listed as one of those competences that are listed as a concurrent function. That means provinces will have a participatory role with regard to the route that legislation must flow through, that must follow through Parliament, as well as with regard to its own internal tourism, call it practices or conference with regard to that one, bodies drafted on a kind of a current framework to be received to the Federal Four Constitution, concurrency as well. Thank you, Jim.
Honourable Chairman and Honourable Members, thank you very much for affording us the opportunity to discuss this legislation. Obviously, as we roll it out in terms of all the instruments and tools that have got to be put in place for its effective implementation, we will be announcing on those. But most importantly is the alignment between our plans as we have tabled and the provisions that are actually contained herein, together with the plans of South African tourism. So the spirit of the Act itself is fully embraced by the department in terms of the practice with regards to the things that we are doing. Of course, it's a piece of legislation. Sometimes even those of us who are on the policy advisory side, we sometimes think this is what it means until the court says no, that's not what they understand it to be. So what it is, it's law, and we will implement it. There will be instances where someone challenges us here and there, and strengthens it as we go, and then we'll be able to adapt accordingly. There are certain practical issues which I do believe we'll have plenty of time to actually go into such details. This person that I've read Daniel was talking about with regard to the conduct of the tour guide, that person was actually making the code of conduct. And I've read Daniel has just been a witness to an offense. I do expect that hopefully you looked at the face of that particular person, and probably you will be providing that particular name to the provincial register as a formal complaint in terms of what has happened. But we will be working with all these attractions to also create much more awareness with regard to what is this code of conduct, to the point where ideally it should actually be there and people should be able to see this is what it is. So as we go into this digitizing phase that we're talking about, one should be able to just go there and see this is it, and this is what it says, and if a person is actually breaking that particular code, then those must actually be reported. But most important is that we want our tour guide to be ambassadors of the country.
Finally, honorable force.
Oh, no. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like I know that in the introduction you said that we should leave the actual issues relating to the Act to a future meeting, but I would like to just highlight one or two issues which I do believe are important that should be incorporated once we move over into finding the issues that we need to bring into the new Act. And that is sustainable and responsible tourism. Well, that's mentioned. I personally believe that we're not doing enough to make it enforceable. Now, South Africa has been ranked number one globally as a responsible tourism destination. We've outranked countries such as America, China, and several others, but it's on paper. Now, simply because we've incorporated sustainable tourism in most of our documentation, it's on that basis that we were ranked number one. But I do believe that we are not doing enough in the ambit of the NDC and also the industry to make sure that sustainable tourism takes center stage. And I do believe that in the Act, it should come out much more stronger in terms of putting it into practice. Now, it could be part of the norms, standards and good practices, etc., but I still believe that the Act should very specifically address the issue of sustainable tourism and what industry should be doing in living up to the good code or at least the Norwegian standard to make sure that that we do give effect to sustainable tourism. Because ultimately, if you drive or advance tourism, it will have an impact on the environment. And I think there we need to make sure that we bridge that gap and address it within the changes that will come forward. Then on the issue of the tour guides, I've raised it, I think, in the very first series of the new fifth term, that quality assurance is a key, because ultimately that's what the Act should produce, is quality assurance in the industry. Now, we've spoken about the Grain Council, and there's going to be a lot of discussion about this going forward, whether it should be mandatory, voluntary, and exactly what are the different issues that should be incorporated in making the Grain Council give effect to that quality assurance. But it's not only pledges of accommodation. We have discussed at length the expansion of the Grain Council, whether it should include other services, and I think here is that one particular service that could do damage to our grains, and that is the tour guides. Because in many cases the script, and I think the gentleman mentioned early on that we've got such a unique offering, that it should not be just a matter of taking people to places of interest and showing them and doing your own observations, but that there should be actually a script. Because it's our band, it's our country, and therefore the tourist guides play a critical role in selling our country for the return visitors, because ultimately those people should become return visitors, not once-off, because that's the business that we, to make sure that people do visit our country again, because we know that tourism dollar can penetrate deeply. So I think the whole issue with regards to the tour guides, and it's been mentioned already, that needs to be addressed in the Act going forward. But I really think that we as a committee, as part of our oversight, should actually see what is the workings of the tourism guide. I know there's this association that looks after their interests, but I think as part of our oversight going forward, we should see or go and find out exactly what it is that, that forms part of the study material, what it is that the script entails. I know that the city of Cape Town, that they've got these buses, the red buses and so on, and I must say that even the script on those buses I disagree with, because they've missed out in so many on so many different or important parts of our history, that it's simply just highlighting a few things. But I think there is an example of part of the oversight that we should go and find out exactly the workings and how they could improve that, and how the legislation could bring that ultimately together. Those are the two issues that I wanted to raise, Madam Chair.
On that note, we hope some of the issues will be covered by the regulations. I would like to thank everybody that have participated, those who came to give us information, and I think we better understand this Act. We came in as we're coming in, and we're not party to it. Now, at least we've got some understanding of how the meeting of this Act came to where it is. And we wait for fair instructions from the department, from the head of the department, if there is anything to look at in future. But for now, we have a good workshop, and I'm sure honorable members will agree with me, the workshop was good, and it raised quite a number of issues, some of which we're not sure of, some of which we think really what that girls entail. And we thank you for the legal office of the legal advisor, senior legal advisor, and office of the acting director general for the information. Thank you very much. And maybe on the way you can have a cup of tea or a cup of anything. Let me find on the way out, because anything is as we are deliberating. Thanks a lot.
Sorry to finish your work. Oh, some of the issues will be covered in the regulations. Do you make your own notes?